We care about our land more than somebody down in Ottawa.
A land code puts the First Nation into the power of government.
The biggest point for me is your ability to protect your reserves lands.
Former chief of our community had the vision to sign and the guts to sign that framework agreement.
Business at the pace of business.
I think it just proves that First Nations lands management really is working.
The good thing about land code, we don't have to sell it. It sells itself.
And joining me right now on the podcast is Phil Goulet from Nipissing First Nation in Ontario. Phil, great to have you here.
My pleasure.
I was mentioning before we started that I've had the awesome privilege to speak with leaders across Canada about land code. And I've really been looking forward to my chat with you because you go back a few years in this process, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think I'm somewhere around day one. If not day one, it'll be at least day two. So.
Yeah. So, and you were one of the first three communities, I think, who signed on?
Yeah, we were one of the, well, the framework agreement was signed actually in 1996, but a group of chiefs, including myself, with Robert Louis from West Bank, met in Hull, Quebec and started talking about a better way of managing our lands other than the Indian Act. And so the seeds were sown back around 1989. Interesting that those dates are important because when the chiefs started talking about land management, from 1989 and the First Nation Land Management Act was given royal assent by Parliament in 1999. So it was a 10-year term. Some people thought within our ranks that this moved along pretty quickly, maybe in government terms, but it seemed like 10 years. It was a long 10 years, but we got there. The framework agreement, of course, that the chiefs signed with Canada in February of 1996 was the real government-to-government instrument that moved everything forward. Canada went back to Parliament and passed the Land Management Act, and I just said it was given royal assent in 1999. And around 2000, our First Nation communities ratified the framework agreement by way of developing their land codes and holding community votes. And so far, fast-forwarding to where we are today, we're at our 99th community that are actually operational, and we expect in April of this year that our 100th community will join us. So it's going to be a pretty exciting time. So here we are over, you know, about a 25-year period from 1996 to now, where 100 communities have come on board, and there are numbers of communities that are waiting to join as well. So it's moving along, pretty remarkable, actually.
Can you take me back to the early days? What was it in particular that piqued your interest in the framework agreement?
Before there was a framework agreement, we were working on an act that would help us manage our lands and take control and management. In 1994, the document, the instrument that was drafted, which became the framework agreement and signed off in 1996, was the inherent right. All parties, Canada included, and First Nations were looking for an instrument that would recognize the inherent right for First Nations to take full control and management of their lands within their jurisdiction. One of the key factors back then that helped Nipissing get involved is we were managing lands under delegated authority from the Minister of Indian Affairs at the time, under two sections, section 53 and 60. So delegated authority gave us the ability to take applications for our community members and our business people to seek out permits and to award permits. But it was taking about 2 years. And we realized by now that moving into land management, that we could issue those permits, depending on the nature of the application, within a month. So we've taken down the two-year period to within a month. That was one of the major attractions. And one of the, if I had to pick one thing today that impressed me as being a chief here for 17 years and a former grand chief, and I was with the Indian Commission of Ontario for 8 years as commissioner, is that the issue in the north is loss of our youth, the out-migration of youth. And we've managed to, many of our communities in the north have managed to retain our youth and to create an in-migration. So with the business we have in our communities and our professional people returning home and building here and conducting their businesses here, like the doctors that have come back home, professional people like lawyers, the people are in that are in business of retail, that type of thing. So forestry, various types of businesses get their permits now from the First Nation and are creating opportunities for our young people. So it's I'm going to look at the homes that they're building and the, you know, raising their children in our community. That's one of the things. It's a long answer here, Richard, but that's one of the things that impressed me, is that, you know, to be able to retain our youth. That was the vision of our elders when I started out, is, you know, how do we make sure our children get educated and stay in the community and help our community grow and create a better quality of life for our children and our grandchildren and those that are yet to be born.
No, it's a great point. And in fact, that's why the local community here that I mentioned, Buckinkeck, that's one of their primary drivers too. You know, it's a small community, 450 on reserve community members, and they want to be able to attract, you know, those folks who left years ago because there were no opportunities. And now they're talking about a future residential development.
Yeah.
So they can bring people back.
Yeah. Well, we have the same similar story. I mean, we, you know, I grew up one of 11 children and our homes were very small, and somehow we managed, and some of the families were 18, 10 children, you know, and now the young people, including my family, they're building homes now where they have two children, and the houses to me look like mansions, you know, so
I can imagine.
It's quite a change. So, yeah. Anyway, it's, you know, things are changing, but a lot of good things are happening. And I think land management has to take some credit. Education for sure has to be given, you know, major element of credit as well.
And I know in the community consultation process leading up to a land code vote, I'm sure that a lot of the communication strategies are, okay, let's get our young people, our young leaders involved here, because they're absolutely pivotal.
Yeah. And I, you know, I was listening to a panel of young First Nation speakers around Christmas, and they were talking about different things that they would like to see, and they were being asked questions about where they see their future. And I was very encouraged by their comments. They all see a brighter future, a better future. And so from listening to them, I can see we're going to be in good hands when, as our young people, you know, go through a transition of taking over, they're going to, my prediction is they're going to continue making First Nation laws that'll be enforceable within our communities. And we'll see in the near future where we'll have our own, which we have now, enforcement people, but we'll also have our own courts in our communities, our justice of peace, our judges, and be able to deal with the issues that young people are bringing to the forefront, which is things like the environment, fish and wildlife management, healthcare, and the well-being of our children and of mankind. So I'm very impressed with what I've been hearing from our young people. And so I see them taking over. And one of the things that they were sharing on that panel is that they have a job to do. We all Canadians have a job to do, and it's to learn about the Indigenous history. And they're continuing to educate larger society about the history of Canada. So I can see them, you know, implementing recommendations that have regarding reconciliation that have come out of the various reviews, inquiries, and commissions. But you know, how many of those were implemented? Very few from what I've read, but I see our young people moving that forward. You know, so I know I'm talking a lot about young people, but I'm very impressed with what they're going to do and build on some of the work that we were able to help out with.
Yeah, no, that's a valuable point. Thank you for going a little bit deeper there, which reminds me, I haven't asked you about the demographics of your community. For those people who aren't familiar with where you're located and what your size is, can you take a few moments to give us a description?
Yeah, we're on the north shore of Lake Nipissing, and our reserve is about 65,000 acres as far as the land base. We have about 30 miles of shoreline, and we have the two large residential subdivisions where we lease land, and we have some commercial properties as well that generate employment and revenue for our community members. We have a large portion of our population are seniors. So obviously we're the same as the rest of the demographic. We're the largest, seniors are the largest, fastest growing demographic right now, I understand. And so we are starting to pay more attention to try and accommodate their needs for the elderly and those that are ill. Unfortunately, those numbers are growing at a rapid rate, people that are getting ill, and these services are not there anywhere that I've seen. So that's, you know, one of the major things that our leaders are trying to grapple with. And of course, I mentioned we have a lot of young educated people now that are coming home. We have about over 2,000 members total, and about 50% of those numbers on reserve. So back years ago, when I started out, there were about 300 on reserve. So it shows you the type of growth that happened. And a lot of that happened, that growth happened since 2003 when we became a land management community. I hope I'm answering the question.
Yeah, no, it's perfect.
Remind me if I missed something.
No, no, it's great. That tweaked another thing too. I was talking with Darcy Bear.
Yes.
Out west, and he mentioned how there was one point where they didn't have a dime in the bank, he said, and a stack of payables is deep. And, but since then, I mean, they've been able to, I think their capital investment over the years has now reached 150 million because it takes infrastructure mm-hmm. to be able to grow and to be able to add those subdivisions or leasing properties. Mm-hmm. Can you address that? Like what kind of an infrastructure build did you have to entertain there?
Well, I'll address it this way, and hopefully I'll be able to answer the question in a good way. But when I started out as chief back in the 70s, early 70s, we had two full-time employees, and we had one part-time truck driver that drove the snowplow and the truck, and we had one truck that worked part-time as well. It was, I think it was broke down more than it was working. So we had a long ways to go. So we started taking over different programs, managing those programs and delving more into different generating opportunities for more business. So in 1992, we had at that time then about 150 full-time employees. So we took over our education programs, our healthcare for our community, and a whole host of economic and social programs that we administer. So the budget has grown substantially. We settled a boundary land claim in 2013. So we, you know, financially we have leverage and equity to continue to grow from that settlement. Plus the revenues that we enjoy today, we have groups like the Miller Paving Group, Miller Construction. I assume they have about 12 different companies. I got to work with the original owner, who has since passed on, Mr. MacArthur, was one of my teachers in this world and taught me in a good way. I just hope I was a good student. Also, Darcy, did you mention Darcy Bear earlier?
Or yeah, I mentioned Darcy. Yes. Yep.
Yeah, Darcy. I have a lot of respect for Darcy and Austin Bear from Saskatchewan. You know, these people have helped me along the way. All of the other First Nations as well that I've worked with. There's one thing that we have here at Nipissing in our Ojibwe language. It's called the Kwidokdamin, and it's in English. It translates into "we help each other." You know, and I can tell you the land management communities across this country. If you phone them at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, at 1:05, they would get back to you and they'd help each other. They just drop everything and help each other. And I'm just so proud of all those lands people, land staff, and administrators and chiefs and councils who come to help each other in a good way without hesitation, so unconditionally too. So
Yeah,
maybe going off track here with the
no,
that's
good.
To your question.
No, that struck me when I first happened upon the website, the Resource Center website, and I looked at all those templates and things that have been built over the years to help those new developmental First Nations. And I thought, this is really cool. Mainstream media and mainstream Canada doesn't seem to know what's happening, but you've got this this bubbling up from the bottom that so many communities are jumping on board the process. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So that was a big step for our community, you know, to move out of that one quarter of the Indian Act, those 44 sections that, were dedicated under the Act to manage land. We've moved out of that major step. So there's still 75% of the Indian Act that remains intact, that still affects our lives. And so again, going back to our young people, they've got a lot of work ahead of them to undo another 75% of the Indian Act at some point in time.
And so you're confident that will happen, are you?
I think our youth will continue to move forward, forge ahead. Evidence of that comes from some of our communities who have gone from Indian Act communities to land management communities to full self-government. So that's happened in Canada three or four times already. So, and those communities always appear to be ready to lend a hand to their brothers and sisters across this country that are willing to want to go forward. So I'm confident it'll happen. I don't know when, but it will happen in the future. I don't think it's too far off for some of them, for some of our communities. Like our Anishinaabeg Nation now is dealing with a governance model. So, you can see there's always ongoing growth in moving away from the Indian Act and moving towards control of all those things that were within our jurisdiction.
When I found out we'd be speaking, I went online and I came across a transcript of you. I think you were appearing before a federal committee. I guess the dates are relevant, but in that testimony, you were mentioning that Nipissing had lost 16 development opportunities within a certain time period.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned the Miller Paving Group in that same talk, but can you talk about some opportunities that came your way, but just went poof because of the bureaucracy?
Well, those in the early years, my early years, that is, there were developers who were manufacturers and wanted to establish in our industrial park, but because it took so long for the department to develop an answer, even whether it was a yes or a no, whether the companies could get their permits or whether they could join venture with our communities, we had to get permission even for those things, for the very basics. So our lives were pretty much controlled by the Indian Act. And the slow pace caused companies to move on to our neighboring communities because they moved at the speed of business, which we weren't. And so our lands manager at the time, who just recently retired after over 30 years of service, who started this process at Nipissing with me and our team, Joan McLeod, had tracked the losses. There were some gains, but there were more losses than there were gains. And so losing 16 businesses lost, you can just imagine the opportunities that left with them. And that was one of the key reasons why, going back to your first question today, is why I ended up in Hull, Quebec with Chief Louis and others, saying it's got to be a better way.
Absolutely. Is there anything that needs to happen at the national level, either in terms of policy or legislation, to enhance the process and help extend the movement?
Yeah, right now there's a bill being proposed to go before Parliament to repeal the First Nation Land Management Act and remove some unnecessary steps that are more of a hindrance to our First Nation communities and wasting, taking up government time. I'm not sure if wasting is a good word for it, but it's almost just an exercise that they really don't have to do, because basically what happens is once the First Nation votes yes, they're going to take control and manage their lands, then we don't need more and more rubber stamps that all take up time. What we need is an opportunity for First Nations to get started, get going. So there's some delays happening there under the Lands Management Act. there's enough teeth in the framework agreement because it's a government-to-government agreement for us to move on. So that would help if Parliament decides this year to change that Land Management Act, have it rescinded, then it would make things much more efficient for First Nations and for government. The other thing is we need to develop our own land registry system, so we have a place of safekeeping for all our land documents, one within our communities and a fallback position, a place, location where we know that all of our records would be kept safely and confidentially.
Has the issue there been, you might have the federal government or a government agency doing some kind of survey work and then the band doing its own survey work and the two never meet?
The registration of, registering the documents and having them deposited in a proper location hasn't happened ever. The department has the documents listed in three different sections, and it makes it quite bureaucratic and it's very confusing for a lot of our communities. So what we need is something very clear and concise, something like if you look at land registries in the provinces and larger municipalities, they manage a lot of registrations per day. And that's the kind of system we need, and that kind of, having the expertise to be able to do that.
Is it still the case where if a community signs on and wants to get in the process, are they funded for 2 years?
Yeah, there's three phases of funding. The first phase is developmental. And if the communities vote yes, then, for example, like the community that we're waiting for this April to vote, if their community votes yes, they'll have use their developmental funding to get them to where they are. And then there is a transitional funding, a revenue stream there, which will help the First Nation go from Indian Act land management to First Nation management under their land code. And then there's the funding you just mentioned, Richard, that funding is operational funding. And then there's about four categories of that, depending on how many transactions and how much land you manage. There's a formula, of course. And that's now being looked at as something that could be also improved. So over the years, we keep looking at these five-year funding formulas and parties sit down and say, well, let's look at what worked and what didn't, what could make this more streamlined, this in a better way, in a more efficient way. So it's getting better all the time. But yeah, the answer is there's a funding for 2 years, then a transitional funding, a one-time transitional funding, and then ongoing operational funding.
Okay. And I guess it's important for a community that wants to entertain the land code process to build capacity at that level and have a person in charge of the whole land question. And then I think there's a local committee that should be struck.
Yeah, there's a land management committee, First Nations lawmaking committee within the community. We have a resource manager here at Nipissing, just to use my community as an example. And we have a fisheries manager who manages our fisheries laws pursuant to our land code. And then there's people out there that manage the forestry and the lands permits, right-of-ways, easements, and all the other 101 things that lands people have to do. I've worked with them over the years, and I would predict that they have at least another 100 years of work to do. So absolutely, they need to be helped, be trained, and given the proper resources to carry out their work.
Sure. And COVID-19 hasn't helped. It tends to have slowed down quite a few things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's causing a lot of stress on many of our people, for sure, everywhere.
Yeah. Just as we wind down, Phil, going forward, what do you think needs to happen to reach more communities? I know your communications folks have a great website and they've launched this podcast and they've got a video series. What's important to reaching out and engaging other communities to see if they might be right for the land code?
Well, the first one I've noticed from experience is that the communities themselves all belong to tribal councils, First Nation organizations. As I mentioned earlier, we spend a lot of time helping each other out, supporting each other. So word of of mouth seems to be a good advertisement. People will always say, how is land management working in your community? And whether it's land management or anything else in our lives, we always like to hear how things are going from our friends and our neighbors. And if they're going in a good way, then say, well, can you come over to our community and talk with us? And that, you know, helps a lot. People say, yeah, we've got some challenges in land management. We're going to overcome them. But overall, it's a good initiative, and we're moving well with it. We're doing well with it. So that, I think, is one of the first ones. The second one is we have to continue to be creative and get the word out there about, you know, land management. Of all the initiatives that the government has tried, land management is probably the one that's been most successful. And if you consider, you know, the amount of money that First Nations have generated back into the economy, as per KPMG studies, it's a fantastic return on the investment as far as government's concerned. The amount of money that comes back into the economy from the jobs that are created, then I would invite people to read, you know, that at their leisure, the KPMG studies, and pretty remarkable at how much money First Nations have generated in Canada.
Yeah, I think that's still up on the website, so we'll include a link in our show notes so people can access that directly. Mm-hmm. Just in closing, I'm sure there would be people intrigued to learn more about Nipissing First Nation and maybe your own involvement. Mm-hmm. What's the best way for someone to get in touch with you, Phil?
You can join us on our Nipissing NFN First Nation website here in at Nipissing. It's managed right now by Genevieve Cucci. She does a fantastic job, and she's, if it's, you know, information required, she's very good at returning calls and getting back to people and sharing anything that we think could be helpful, you know, about our community and about where we're at and where we're going. So there's a lot of information there. And if someone would like to call me up and say hello, I'm here at Nipissing, Phil21 at persona.ca. And I'd be happy to hear from them. And it'd be good to keep chatting and keep moving forward, even during COVID-19.
Anything else you want to add, Phil, before we hit the snooze button here?
Well, we've celebrated, we're celebrating the anniversary of starting with 13 communities back in 1996 to 100 communities in 2021. I think that's going to continue to grow. And I wish everybody that's on board and those that are coming on board success and continued success and best of health and only good things. And I want to say miigwech and thank you to you for providing me with this opportunity to chat with you.
Yes, miigwech. Thank you very much, Phil. I appreciate it. Join us in the coming weeks as we explore the land code in more detail and the personal journeys of leaders involved in the process. You can visit the website at labrc.com for a wealth of information, and you can follow the Resource Center on Facebook. You can also subscribe to this podcast on all the major platforms. And we'd really appreciate it if you could help get the word out by just telling one colleague about the show. I'm Richard Perry. Thanks for listening.